Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Bloomsbury people are, in a way, practical pioneers in a deeper understanding of human sexuality.
Uh-huh.
And we now have learned to distinguish between sex and gender, for example. Bloomsbury made that distinction.
The project began really a personal fascination with Dürer, not only with his work, his paintings, his etchings, his engravings, his drawings, but also with his diaries and with his attempts to, codify and to research the art of painting. And he began to explore the self, the individual against the larger backdrop of dramatic history, let's say, in a way that hadn't been done in the medieval ages before.
Creative cross-currents in Europe and the United States, this week on Soundings. My guests are Rita Dove, a poet who teaches at the University of Virginia, and Robert Terhorst of the University of Rochester. First, Rita Dove discusses the late medieval German artist Albrecht Dürer. Following that, Robert Terhorst discusses the Bloomsbury groups in England and the historian Henry Adams in the United States. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Rita Dove worked on a sequence of poems entitled Dürer's Beauty, which draws upon the work of Albrecht Dürer, the 15th and 16th century German artist. In 1987, Rita Dove was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her collection of poems, Thomas and Beulah. Here is Rita Dove.
In about the midpoint of his career, around 1500 or so, he had already produced some of the masterpieces that we know, both paintings and all of his self-portraits, interestingly enough. There are about four Dürer self-portraits, and if you saw them in museums, you'd recognize them immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a reputation. He had a really substantial body of work. And then he wrote in his diary something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing, that the work was good, but it was unthought out.
Mm.
And so he began to study, and what he meant by that was that he had used his natural talent up to that point, but there were things he sensed, these gaps in his knowledge as a painter. So he began to study perspective, he began to study human proportion, and he began to do a series of drawings, for instance, which are isolated. This is very unusual for the Middle Ages, but there are isolated moments where he tries to get every detail, and the ones that we know the best are the hare, the rabbit,
mm-hmm.
which is a drawing where you can see practically every hair on the rabbit's body.
It quivers on the page in front of you. It's as though you've encountered it in a natural setting.
Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely fascinating because usually at that time, around the 1500s, if there were an animal or someone were to draw an animal, it would be a study for a larger painting. There weren't isolated still lives of just one rabbit.
Uh-huh.
I can use another drawing as an example, and that is the drawing of the great piece of turf. It's a large plot of grass that Dürer must have dug up and brought back to his studio, and he draws it in every detail. In that sense, it's much like a botanist's drawing in a book, but he did this not with any point to it. He didn't plan to put it in the painting, but he was teaching himself. I don't mean to belabor the drawings of the hare and the great piece of turf, but if one can consider the fact that Dürer dedicated as much energy to these fairly modest drawings in scope as he did to, for instance, the great engravings, which are the ones, Jerome in his study, the knight and the devil, and the knight, the horseman, and the devil, and also Melancholia, which, if you remember, is the engraving of a woman bent over all of the kind of implements, tools of intellectual pursuit. There are compasses and pens and parchment, and she's utterly melancholic. It's a very complicated engraving. I feel, though, that the kind of detail that he invested in that the grass and those plants served him very well in the later engraving. And in fact, anything that you make yourself do in order to learn to do it, do something else better, is going to serve you well.
Mm.
One of the things that was very fascinating to me about Dürer was that he suffered from what he called melancholia generosissima.
Which goodness, what in the world?
The
is
great melancholy.
Yeah.
It's the big M.
I fall, I bleed upon the thorns of life. Huh?
Yes, but this melancholy, especially in the Middle Ages, was considered to be not just a depression, but it was, in fact, something that artists and intellectuals fell prone to. It was the result of too much thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And his great, his etching, Melancholia I, is actually the title of it, refers to the first level of melancholia, which was that devoted to the artists and the artisans. And this intrigued me too, because I think almost anyone who is involved in some kind of intellectual pursuit, which is a very lonely enterprise at many levels, has some sort of melancholy. And I'd like to read a poem which is called Melancholia I, but perhaps will answer better than any of my ramblings here, exactly what it is in Albrecht Dürer's character as an artist that I feel intersects with mine. Melancholia I. In this poem, Albrecht Dürer is speaking, and there are references to a few of those drawings we talked about. Melancholia I. Dazzled by the mere contemplation of the pentagram, the dodecahedron, that most noble of solids, I am like a horseman without a horse, practicing vertigo, new feet balancing earth. Compass, ruler, cannot govern the ecstasy of sight. A corner abruptly turned onto the spectacle of a metzgerai, on the chopping block a hare skinned, still congealing, sketched in 15 minutes before it can stiffen. How is it possible the hand moves before it thinks, and feels muscles' slick resistance against bone? How then drape on the white interface of skin, replenish fur until all's intact again, plumped and dry? Oh, this country is a brutal place for a gentleman, raw under the brushed furs, and the heart clenched so long the merest warmth would incinerate. How I shiver for the sun.
This is the artist's lament. It is a timeless note that you have sounded. I suspect that there's some of your own personality here, as well as this backward glance that you're making toward Albrecht Dürer, Rita Dove.
Yes, that's true. I confess. I felt that his melancholia really spoke to mine at times. Of course, there are some wonderful moments, too.
Uh-huh.
We very rarely write about the happy moments because we're too busy being happy. But I think also and he writes about these things in his diary and in his painter's manuals, the wonder that comes from, in the end, creating something, even if you try to figure out how you did it, even if even if there are principles, mm-hmm, to be learned and to be practiced.
Does the hand move before the mind?
Before the mind, right. Mm-hmm. You know, how is it possible? And how can the hand, in this case, actually feel the muscles beneath the rabbit, the hair?
You have some literary kinsmen, cousins, kinspeople here, but you make me think of Samuel Johnson's Melancholia. Hawthorne has a wonderful story about a man who thinks too much, Ethan Brand. And then there's, J.D. Salinger, perfect day for banana fish.
Banana fish.
That responsibility, that burden of being an artist, and yet the longing that you feel to be free of it at the same time. Which, Rita Dove, is the more onerous of terms, freedom or responsibility? Which, when you look at this, do we have a contradiction there or a continuum when you look at these as an artist?
I think we have no contradiction. I think it is a continuum. And I think that freedom is a far more onerous term.
Uh-huh.
I think that in a certain way, the artist has the responsibility to be free, too. The artist has the responsibility to push. The artist has the responsibility to push forward as much as they dare, and then a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of poetry, this is raised to the nth degree, because you want to be as free as possible, traveling in the mind and in the emotions in the poem, and yet the poem is contained in a very small vessel.
Right.
You want to do it in as few words as possible, and that is really like dancing with a ball and chain.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Rita Dove. Let me be a little personal and nosy here. What is a black poet from the American Midwest doing writing about a medieval engraver?
I've asked myself that question, anticipating it, I think, from the looks on people's faces sometimes when I say that I'm doing this thing on Albrecht Dürer.
And, about who, where, yeah, when?
And, I mean, of course, there are lots of things. And first of all, the idea of choosing a white German painter. My first reaction is to say, why not?
Mm-hmm.
That as a artist myself, as a writer, I feel a kinship across the ages with his sense of inquiry and honesty, and that intrigues me. Also, though, I think because it is important for me that people see black writers, black artists as artists and not pigeonholed in some section called black art, so that you can conveniently put them on one shelf and forget about them, that in fact an artist who is black is a human being with the same inquiries and longings as the white artist or the Hispanic artist, and that the whole world should be an arena for discovery.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Rita Dove is a poet and professor of English at the University of Virginia. During her recent fellowship year at the center, Rita Dove worked on a sequence of poems entitled Dürer's Beauty. Soundings on Creative Crosscurrents continues. My guest now is Robert Terhorst, a professor of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Rochester. Robert Terhorst is the author of The Fortunes of the Novel, forthcoming from Princeton University Press. Among his current projects, Robert Terhorst is writing about the historian Henry Adams in America and the Bloomsbury Groups in England. The Bloomsbury Groups included the novelist Virginia Woolf, the critic and biographer Lytton Strachey, and the moral philosopher G.E. Moore. Here is Robert Terhorst.
Well, there are two Bloomsbury phenomena, one pre-World War I and the other between the two wars. In that, the central relationship, Virginia and Leonard Woolf married in 1912. An earlier relationship that began before this marriage and continued until the other partner's death was that between Lytton Strachey and Virginia Woolf. Lytton Strachey was homosexual, but found himself, for reasons which he didn't clearly understand, proposing marriage to Virginia Woolf one time. The depth of the attachment is, I think, expressed by that blunder. Lytton took it back the next day. But it is, theirs is a kind of spiritual marriage which links with the Leonard Virginia Woolf marriage.
What you're telling me after a fashion that these relationships, as multifaceted and ambiguous and complicated as they are, become emblematic of our understanding and misunderstanding of sex and gender in the 1980s? We're finally just catching up to the Bloomsbury types. Is that it?
I think that's true. I think especially among the males, that male role in Bloomsbury and this incident between Lytton and Virginia is perhaps symbolic of that or emblematic of that, is males, particularly in this group, were able to define and confuse themselves in ways that only laterally have become even minimally acceptable.
Well, I think of a term, you help me with the etymology or the recency, male bonding. Is that the kind of thing that the Bloomsbury people would have sneered at, approved?
No, it's actually, in a way, it's at the root of Bloomsbury, because most of the male contingent of Bloomsbury come out of a Cambridge group called the Apostles, and that was a very much of a male bonding group with a long history. But people like Maynard Keynes, the economist, Lytton, Leonard Woolf himself,
G.E. Moore.
Moore was the older.
He was sort of a magnet, was he not?
He was, in a strange way. I'm interested. Actually, I'm thinking ahead through Bloomsbury to another book, which is a couple down the road here, but a book that obsesses me. It's a book on Henry Adams and the American Gilded Age. And I'm very interested in Adams in terms of his circle. And I'm very interested in how people in very differing callings and dedications, how they come together as a cultural mass and how they make their mark on their time, not only as individuals, but also as groups. So it has been, in approaching this Henry Adams project, I've used Bloomsbury as a means of trying to think out some of the problems.
It's a kind of model for you as you figure out how these cultural phenomena occur?
Yes. It's how...
You're not suggesting that Henry Adams represents an American form of Bloomsbury, or are you?
A kind of American anticipation of it. Henry Adams tried to make Washington, before its time, into the cultural capital of the United States. He moved from Cambridge. He quit being a Harvard professor, and he had a lot of money, and he went down to Washington with the idea of forming a cultural core around himself, and to a large measure did so. And this is what Adams wanted to establish: a salon in the French manner, but an American one, that would have very great impact, and he certainly had the connections as well as the money.
Would you characterize it as a success, as a failure? What kind of a mixture of those two, this effort of Adams?
I would. In one dreadful thing happened when Marian Adams killed herself, and that was it cut short the fullest flowering of this effort, because Marian Adams was absolutely essential. There was a group, the central group of the Adams circle was called the Five of Hearts Club, and they were the two Adamses, the two Hayes, and Clarence King. But for Adams, the missing element, and this is something which he and James shared, was a real understanding, a real place for women in men's lives. What Adams found missing from the American scene was the kind of female presence that one found in the best English or French circles.
Does this have anything to do with his famous title, the Dynamo and the Virgin?
The Virgin and the Dynamo.
Have I got that backwards?
Right, but okay. This you touch on something very, very important because of Adams's study of the centrality of women to a male-dominated culture. And I believe that this, he found his own New England upbringing singularly lacking in the kind of force that splendid women do bring, even in highly chauvinist times, to what seems to be a male-dominated culture.
Well, when his wife killed herself, did he simply abandon this effort to find the right kind of woman, the archetypal woman that he was looking for in not only his own life but in his work?
He did find in the wife of Senator Don Cameron Allen a woman whom he worshipped. In a very beautiful woman, Mrs. Dawn Cameron Allen, a very beautiful woman. Between Adams and her, there are many, many letters. There's also one saying, "No, I would not marry even you." Peculiar letter. But Mrs. Dawn Cameron Allen became Marion Adams's surrogate, I suppose.
Was this an illicit relationship, or this was simply a platonic love that existed between the two of them?
I think it was a courtly love relationship, which of course is sexual at base, but by the rules of that game is not allowed to express itself sexually. So there is this wonderful recognition of the worth, the value of women in Adams. That's central, I think, to Adams's thinking. It's all very ironic and tricked out in all kinds of mannerisms in many ways, but that's an extraordinary recognition and really puts Adams in a unique situation for his time.
Let's go back momentarily, Bob Terhorst, to the Bloomsbury Group. We established that Bloomsbury was a sort of model for you in your investigation into Henry Adams's cultural importance in our own history. In what particular way do you find this model compelling?
The relationship between Leonard and Virginia Woolf, despite all the differences that separate them, could be seen as not dissimilar to that between Henry and Marion Adams. The centrality of Leonard Woolf says in his memoirs that Virginia was the only truly the only person on the level of genius that he had met, and there was in Leonard Woolf a worship, I guess. There have been recent biographies that have criticized Woolf's relationship to Virginia. I haven't read those. I would be hesitant to criticize Woolf, but what he did was to encourage, nurture, protect his wife's talent, genius, and do everything he could, as he understood it, to foster her artistic development.
Does the spirit of Bloomsbury survive today? Is there anything in our contemporary culture that you look around and find analogous to what went on in either of the Bloomsbury groups? Is this pretty much the subject of scholarship?
I think Bloomsbury was in many ways a precursor of social mores of the middle class at large in the English-speaking world. And I think it's like golf. It's something that started being restricted and ended up being accessible at any rate to a great many people.
Or psychoanalysis.
But there is always, and this is one of its charms, there is always and this enraged people. They thought it was snobbery. There's always an aristocratic stamp, not of birth, but of intellectual distinction, of considerateness, of decency, of manners. This is the Moore input, as a matter of fact. The ethical preoccupations of that group, even though their moral behavior was at variance with what was generally accepted around them, there was a very, very deep ethical commitment and a deep commitment of friends to friends, which outlasted marriages, all sorts of normal commitments. There's friendship, probably an aristocratic but wonderfully deep and caring friendship is probably the hallmark of that group. I don't know if we cultivate friendship that way among groups anymore. I think Bloomsbury 1 and 2 have passed into history, but they leave us with a kind of puzzling model of the good life that is very relevant to many of our concerns today.
Robert Terhorst teaches at the University of Rochester. He's the author of The Fortunes of the Novel, forthcoming from Princeton University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 485. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations featuring two foreign scholars at the National Humanities Center. My guests will be Yang Johan, a professor of comparative literature at Peking University, and Nikita Pokrovsky of Moscow University. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor two enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Happy birthday this week to the British Museum. The world-famous repository opened in mid-January 1759. The world's first nuclear-powered submarine, the Nautilus, was launched in mid-January 1955. 11 years later, in mid-January 1966, an American B-52 collided with its refueling plane over Palomares, Spain, spilling 4 hydrogen bombs and scattering radioactive plutonium. The Versailles Peace Conference, ending the First World War, formally opened in mid-January 1919. Birthdays this week include the elder statesman of the American Revolution, Benjamin Franklin, born in mid-January 1706, the civil rights leader, Martin Luther King Jr., in 1929, the rock and roll legend Chuck Berry, born in mid-January 1926, the French industrialist André Michelin, born in 1853, the Scottish engineer and inventor James Watts, born in mid-January 1736, the American entertainer Ethel Merman, born in 1908, and in mid-January 1926, Newton Minow, the former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. It was Newton Minow who characterized American broadcasting as a vast wasteland. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Creative Cross-Currents in Europe and the United States, this week on Soundings. Rita Dove, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet from the University of Virginia, discusses her sequence of poems about the German artist Albrecht Dürer. Robert Terhorst of the University of Rochester discusses the American historian Henry Adams and the Bloomsbury groups in England. Creative Cross-Currents, this week on Soundings.